Well, tonight on Coast to Coast, Eldon Taylor back with us. His latest work, I Believe When What You Believe Matters. Looking forward to this mind-body connection. And stay tuned. Eldon is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Eldon Taylor's been researching the power of the mind for years, considered to be an expert in the areas of hypnosis, subliminal communication as well. And he is the host of his own radio program, Provocative Enlightenment, the inventor of the patented InnerTalk technology. And here he is back on Coast to Coast, a Coast to Coast favorite, Eldon Taylor. Eldon, how are you?
I am wonderful, sir. And, you know, we haven't talked in a while. I just learned that you have a television show. In fact, I just subscribed to your television show. How fantastic. You do TV now, too, huh?
We do a little bit of everything, huh? We keep ourselves busy. But you know what? Keeping yourself busy keeps you young. I think that's state of mind, isn't it?
It is. It is. I totally agree with you. You know, it isn't just keeping busy. It's having that passion that you bring to everything that you do. Indeed, you know, one of my favorite stories is told to me by a friend who moonlights doing some disc jockey work. And he's a radio show host. And he told me one day, you know, I'm doing this gig for a 50th anniversary, 50th year or graduation anniversary, and these are high school students celebrating their 50th, and he's got all the music all queued up for exactly what they'd be accustomed to playing maybe in their senior year, the dancing music, etc. And he said, and he tells me, you know, they came limping in, and I'm looking out there, and I'm thinking, holy cow, how many knee replacements, how many hip replacements?
What oh, my gosh.
Do? You know, I got all this music. I mean, what do I do? And he says, you know, well, I had no choice. I just started playing, and pretty quick, they were putting the canes down. They were up there dancing. He said they limped in, and they danced out. You know, it takes very little for us to remember what it's like to be young and vital and at any age. And remembering it actually can produce it. Ellen Langer ran a really wonderful study where she took older people into the in the mountains of New York, Langer of Harvard, and she surrounded them with the kind of material, magazines, music. She controlled their conversations, conversations that would have been taking place it back when they were in their 20s. So if they talked about politics, they talked about what the kind of politics would have been in the 20s and in their 20s. And the magazines and all the other material represented that era. And she measured them on a pre and a post basis. Their length of stride increased. Their memories improved. They stood more erect. Independent observers graded them as being younger on average 3 to 5 years. This amazing data coming out of just remembering, you know, what it's like to be young. Mine's incredible that way, George.
Good for you. And, you know, Eldon, you've been with me a long time on this program. Lots of folks brand new to the show, probably sitting back going, oh, this is exciting, but who's Eldon Taylor? Let's go back way, way back. Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Sure, happy to do so. You know, I came into doing what I'm doing through the back door. I mean, it's that simple. I was, you know, I had one of those childhoods that you look on and you think, you know, at the time I thought, you know, I'm the most unfortunate person on the planet. My father this and my mother that. And I left home when I was very young. And that didn't lead to the best consequences. And in time, I found myself practicing criminalistics, running lie detection examinations, supervising investigations, conducting interrogations, maybe a forensic hypnosis session or so. But I was very jaded, and that's the point I want to get to. I was very suspicious of everyone. I didn't trust people. I never went home the same way two nights in a row. I'm always looking over my shoulder. You know, paranoid in a sense. In fact, you know, sometimes that paranoia was reinforced in real life. I can remember feeling really out of sorts with myself and thinking, you know, when I was younger, I went to church and somehow I got something out of that because I would come out and I would feel more balanced than I am. I think I'm gonna I'm going to have to find a church and go to it. I hadn't been to church in years. And so I chose a church to go to that I thought would be, you know, fine. And, you know, I didn't know anybody there. And I arrived a little bit early, and they had a little bookstore in the back. And I kind of looked through their books. And then I went and sat down, and some people came in. And the first thing I saw were the two people, a couple, that were going to be passing the plate. And the female was the suspect in a case that I was handling that I was going to have to deal with on Monday morning. And I'm sitting there in church looking at her thinking, oh, goodness, not even here. And I, you know, I got up and I walked out. That's how jaded, how suspect I was of everyone. So from the outside, I looked like I was very successful. You know, I had the big cars. I had the big agency. I had the reputation and the fame. I had the clients. But my personal life was just a shambles. Part of my lesson, where I am today and the kinds of things that I've learned and the reasons I do what I do, came as a result of an epiphany I had. As a criminalist with my own agency, I heard about some research that was being done in Los Angeles Police Department in preparation for the 84 Olympics. And according to this research, they were using a subliminal message that was designed to dehydrate suspects. So in a terrorist abduction scenario, the idea was simply this. There is so much time spent negotiating on the phone. We'll play this white noise, pink sound, that sounds like the sound of an air conditioner or a furnace, with these subliminal messages. We'll tell the perpetrators that they're in an infected area, that we need to move them, irrespective of anything else that we do in the negotiations. If they see any symptoms or signs of dehydration, vomiting, diarrhea, et cetera, you know, you need to do something and act right away. Well, they tested this scenario out on police cadets in the academy, and I heard that they had to terminate it after 3 days because they were effectively dehydrating cadets. And I thought, holy cow, you know, you can do this with a technology that people aren't even aware that you're doing. Now, this is going back late 70s, early 80s. You know, I tried to verify that story, and no one has ever stepped up, and I've never been able to verify it, nor has anyone ever, denied it. But what I did as a result was begin to investigate the technology. And you know, the long and the short of that was I called all these manufacturers that were making programs, and I asked them how they were doing it, and you would have thought I asked them for the secret recipe to Coca-Cola. So, you know, I mean, where I am, if someone makes a science claim, they should be willing to back it up. Right. So, you know, these people were making these claims, and I just wanted, you know, how would I replicate the claims that you're making, you know, if that's the instance? But it didn't get me anywhere. So I went out and I bought all their programs, and I sent them off to Audio Forensic Laboratories. And there, Anthony Pelicano, who specialized at the time in taking material that had been recorded, but it was masked material. It was, a hypothetical could go this way. You have an undercover sting, and just as your suspect says something incriminating, a jackhammer goes off, a garbage truck arrives, and so you end up with a recording, but you've lost the quality of what's being said. It's all muted, it's mixed in. So what Anthony did, and did very, very well, was separate this out and recover that information so it could be played in the court of law, et cetera. So I sent him to Anthony, and he called me on the phone and said, Eldon, there isn't anything here. Well, that's a whole other long story. But the fact is, I then went up to the University of Utah. I went through their psych abstracts, Medline, et cetera. I put some people up there actually getting all these abstracts because those days we didn't have Google. It was still, you know, Mosaic or some, you know, you needed a librarian to make sure that she could get back home when they went out on the web. At any rate, I got all this information, and that led to developing a technology. It's really not subliminal. It's a shadow technology. But I took this technology out into my lie detection practice. I don't want to get ahead of myself here. And the idea was, you know, I would use this in my lie detection practice to minimize inconclusives. In lie detection, 20 to 25% of all the tests that are run come back inconclusive because of situational stress with an honest person. You know, they're so afraid that you're going to call them deceptive that they bring this situational stress in, and it clouds the difference in a zone of comparison chart between relevance and irrelevance or pre-stressed questions. And then you have your countermeasures folks, you know, and they come in and they do whatever manipulation they're going to do. And even if you see them manipulating, you know, tensing their muscles or pushing their foot on a concealed thumbtack in an irrelevant, so as to exaggerate that irrelevant and thereby flatten it out by comparison to irrelevant. Even when you see that, you can point it out to them, you know, you're limited to what's in the chart. You can walk out and say, you know, I know this guy's telling, you know, he's not telling the truth, he's lying, but his charts don't say so, or his charts are inconclusive because of. So if you could knock out that 20, 25% inconclusive, well, you could just be this hero. That was my idea. So we created this technology, we employed it, we, you know, started it in the practice, and hey, it worked very well. It worked so well, we were getting confessions in the first half hour. And you never get confessions for the first 3 hours. You know, you just let people sit and cool their feet. In fact, honestly, George, you know, there were times I felt like saying, whoa, hold it a minute, I get paid by the hour.
Yeah.
But a friend of mine then at Utah State Prison said, Eldon, if this works so well here, can you take it out to the prison? Can we use it to lower hostility and aggression, to interrupt the recidivity rate, you know, to increase
good idea.
Reflectivity and so forth? And I didn't know, you know. So we went out to the prison system. We created a very tight double-blind study. It was the first of its kind. We used the latest in psychometric instrumentation. And you know, while I'm on this subject, I'm going to reveal my own epiphany, if it's all right. What we learned from all that psychometrics, including the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the so-called MMPI, wasn't new to any of us. I mean, we had high scores in self and social alienation. Okay. But when we visited with this inmate population, we got a common denominator from them. And that common denominator that came out was their ability to displace responsibility for everything in their life. So what we would hear is we would hear a rationalization very much like, you know, oh, but for the grace of God, there go you.
Yeah.
My daddy was an alcoholic. My mommy was a prostitute. You know, the neighbor boy mainlined me when I was 12 years old.
I got beaten, everything.
Yeah. Now, usually these were exaggerated stories, but even when they weren't, you could have two brothers come from the same home, live in the same environment, but make different choices. One would be in the prison system. One might be a doctor in a teaching hospital. So what it came down to was the choices that these people made, given, you know, the circumstances and stimuli that they had to deal with. All right. Their function of displacing responsibility gave them no opportunity for rehabilitation. So long as I couldn't do anything about it, so long as it's not my fault, so long as, but for the grace of God, I'm asking for sympathy. I'm asking you to understand me. I mean, listen, what else could I do? In order to get any kind of rehabilitation, the first thing we had to do was turn that around. And I suggest that what we do was employ a forgiveness set. And we did. I forgive myself. I forgive all others. I am forgiven. And we mixed that with a combination of self-esteem affirmations to create this program that would begin to prime their self-talk. Well, the fact, the bottom line is it worked very, very well. In fact, it worked so well that the prison system cloned it out and created voluntary libraries throughout all of their facilities from minimum to max. And other prison systems copied it. It was very, very successful. But here was my epiphany. I'm listening to these inmates, and reasoning this out, and I realize I'm just as angry as they are. The difference is I have found a socially acceptable way to act out my anger, to act out my aggression, to act out my displacement of responsibility, because it was their fault that I had to go through this. It was my dad's fault that I did, you know. And that attitude literally disempowers a human being. It robs you of your own franchise. If you're going to ever realize your potential, you must first take full responsibility for everything in your life. Not that you're in charge of everything that comes to you, but you are in charge of how you respond to it. And when you take that attitude, and when you decide that what you're going to do is, forgive me, but find the good in everything and be proactive and go, well, your life changes, and it changes for the better. So the long and the short of it is that's where I'm coming from. And in fact, that seeded very much, George, the writing of I Believe, because I heard so many stories from people why they did what they did, and I'd walk away shaking my head and think, what, who on earth in their right mind could rationalize that way? But the more research I did, the more I realized that there is no such thing as an inconsequential belief. Our beliefs, our life beliefs, you know, we like to segment and we like to think, well, I have beliefs about my spirituality, I have beliefs about politics, I have beliefs about my work ethic, I have beliefs about specific people. It doesn't matter how you fractionate it, the fact is they're all like one giant spider web. You tweak one belief in one place, it causes the entire web to vibrate. And it's critical that we come to understand that for lots of reasons you and I will get into in the next couple of hours.
Well, you did. It sounds like something that you have had so much experience for that you're ready for it.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, I think sometimes we teach what we want to learn. And to me, you must learn to walk what it is that you teach. And I truly believe that long before I knew those things, I was being guided to where I am now. You know, I truly believe that, well, let me say this. Stuart Wilde, who crossed over, and you have a lovely... Yeah, and he was a superhuman being. I mean, I can still remember him coming into a store that I used to own, a bookstore that I used to own, to give a presentation. And he got out of this, you know, long limo, and he had on these wild cowboy boots with big red eagles on them and his pants tucked into them. And I thought, holy cow, but what a dynamite human being. Just a dynamite human being. Stuart wrote a book, said life is not meant to be a struggle. Now, one of the things that, you know, I have always thought about is, yeah, maybe it's not meant to be a struggle, maybe it shouldn't be a struggle, but we gain a lot of strength out of struggle. And sometimes it is the struggle in which we find our meaning. There's a marvelous story about the Emperor Moth that I think just, you know, epitomizes this message. You know, there's a scientist. The scientist falls in love with Emperor Moth. He decides he's really going to study him. They're just a gorgeous, magnificent creature. He finds one that has spun a cocoon, and he retrieves it, and he takes it to his lab, and he watches it. He takes careful notes every day. He is just fixed on this cocoon. And the day finally comes that the Emperor Moth is going to hatch, come out of that cocoon, and he breaks through a little bit, and he begins to chew on the cocoon, and the scientist is all excited, and he stands around, and he watches him, and the day goes by, and, you know, it's coming night, and this moth has struggled, and he's fallen back, and he's struggled, and he's fallen back, and it's just, he's got these two large eyes looking right at the scientist, and he just can't break through, and the scientist thinks, my God, how can I leave him like that?
I love it. Eldon, stay with us. We're going to finish it up, and we'll come back and talk more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Wednesday night into Thursday morning, we are switching XM channels. We're going to be moving to XM Talk Channel 246. So those of you who do pick us up on XM, Just make a note of that. Wednesday night into Thursday, XM Talk, channel 246. Back in a moment, more with Eldon Taylor as we talk about his latest work, I Believe, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Eldon Taylor with us. Eldon, let's finish up the moth story, and we'll go on to some of these incredible things that you put in, I Believe.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, remember, we have our scientist. The scientist is observing the moth. The moth is having great difficulty. It has gone on all day, a veritable ordeal. The scientist looks down at the moth. The moth's two eyes are looking back at him, and he thinks, you know, how can I be so cruel? I mean, the least I can do is help him out. And he takes his tweezers and his scissors, and he very carefully opens up the cocoon. And the moth falls out and dies reasonably soon thereafter. What the scientist then learns is that it is this struggle through the cocoon that the moth must make in order to push the fluids back into the body in such a way that it becomes aerodynamic. Without the struggle, it dies.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of the things that we experience in our life, we look at as a struggle. You know, why should this happen to me? Why should I have had... But everyone that I have associated with in my life that is successful has had to deal with the struggles. They've had to, if you will, go through that trial of fire that tempers the steel that made them who they are. So, you know, that's the attitude that, for all intent and purposes, is the pragmatic way to deal with the issues that we encounter that, for all intent and purposes, maybe we would prefer not to.
Let's talk about I Believe. Give me the overall perspective of this.
Well, the whole idea behind the book was to illustrate some of the things that we just don't think about by way of the power of our beliefs. Let me, for example, start off this way. I said that we have a web of beliefs. The web of beliefs is anchored in a physical being. Our physical being has certain rules, like an automobile. And those rules, those operating rules, most of us aren't very aware of. So the fact of the matter is, we go through life doing things, and we might be amazed that what we're doing is helping or injuring our being. Take, for example, I like this as a simple illustration, and everybody can relate to this, and the entire audience out there can do this, and George, you can do it with me too. Whether you're sitting or standing, pick up your right foot and begin to make clockwise circles with that right foot, if you will. Just, you know, clockwise circles. Now, while you make the clockwise circles, write a six in the air. Now, if you did that, what you found is that your foot reversed directions when you drew the six with your right hand in the air.
Absolutely right. How'd you know that?
Well,
you're remote viewing all of us, aren't you?
Yes. See, you are hardwired in certain ways. So if I tell you, if you write a check to a charity that you really care about, the brain rewards you. It bathes you with endorphins. You say, oh, really? If I tell you, if you smile, just fake that smile. The brain rewards you with endorphins. You know, again, but now if I tell you the research, the hard data shows that when you tell a lie, it injures, impedes the optimal operation of your immune system, then you're really surprised. But that's how the system works. That's how you are wired. So, what I wanted to do, and I Believe, was first of all show you all of the areas that most of us are just ignorant about, the power of belief. I mean, for a long, long time, we had no way of explaining how multiple personality disordered patients could, in one personality, be normal blood sugar, snap your fingers, they change personality, and all of a sudden they're hypoglycemic. Or in one personality, they're allergic to a drug, and the next personality, they're not. One personality, they're near blind, seriously, visual impairment. In the next personality, they have perfect vision. The one that really gets you is those that in one personality, eye color is brown, and the next personality. Snap your fingers as quick as they change. I color as blue. Now, today we think maybe this whole epigenetics area may be the mechanism by which this happens. We don't really know for sure, but this we do know. When the personality change takes place, what happens is the individual's belief about who they are changes. I'm not Susan, I'm Susie. Susie has fun, Susie parties, Susan's a stick in the mud. That change in belief, that instantaneous memory difference gives rise to this physical change. Now, you know, that's pretty remarkable if you think about it. But more remarkable than that, when we look at the research, the effect that belief has, we see that it's not just individual. There are many collective beliefs. One that I really like to share with people has to do with the expectation factor. The University of Washington pioneered this research. Several other universities have since replicated it. But what they did in Seattle is they created a bar, a regular lounge, a beautiful bar. You know, you've all the liquor displayed very nicely on a wall, backed by mirrors, just a beautiful bar. Now, students were selected to, you know, experiment with drinking in this bar. And, of course, they were observed from researchers behind one-way glass. And what they saw was, you know, they have a drink or two drinks, and the inhibitions began to fall, and behavior began to change. You made three and four drinks, motor skills seriously impaired. You know, beyond that, they had drunk students. And these drunken students, they were so intoxicated that even under the threat of losing their driver's license, they couldn't, you know, walk a straight line. But here's the bottom line. They didn't have any alcohol. They only thought they did.
Uh-huh.
Now, the glasses, you know, in all fairness, the rims of the glasses were dipped in alcohol, so they had the smell of alcohol.
So they figured the whole thing had alcohol.
Yes. You know, you, the expectation that you were drinking alcohol combined with what you thought your limit might be created this drunkenness. You know, when you think about that, that's pretty incredible. I one of my favorite demonstrations, and the audience can go out and get this, and they can try it themselves, is called the checker shadow illusion. Just think of it as a chessboard illusion. If you Google chessboard illusion, you'll end up at MIT with Professor Edward Adelson. We've exchanged some dialogue, and here's the bottom line with this. In a live presentation, and I've done this, you can take two squares off of this chessboard, and the two squares will be exactly the same color. If the listening audience goes out and does this, photocopy it. Make two photocopies and cut the squares A and B out. You'll see they're identical. They're exactly the same color. But what happens when you put them on that chessboard? You put the A back in a dark place, and you put the B back where a light place belongs. We are so conditioned to see light, dark, light, dark, light, dark on a chessboard. Mm-hmm. We see light, dark, even though they're both the same color. You know, you show this to someone, they say, wait a minute, how's that possible?
Wow. Now, when do they finally see it? Do you really have to stare at it?
Well, you don't see it. You are just so convinced, George. Our belief system is so rigid about what a chessboard looks like, you don't see it. Try it for yourself. I showed it to my wife, and she said, what's the trick? I said, there's no trick. Here are the two squares. Take these two squares. Are they the same color? Yeah. All right, now slide them onto the chessboard. She slid them on. How's that possible? I'm looking at them. Change. But if you put them on different squares, if you just flip them around, you know, they change again. So instead of putting A on a dark, put it on a light. It becomes light. Put B on the dark. It becomes dark. It is a matter of the rigidity by which our expectation operates that gives rise to seeing this. I don't know anyone that has ever been able to see it for what it is, in light of this shadowed board effect. It's an incredible effect. So when people talk about their beliefs, you know, as I said, they typically like to compartmentalize. But what they're not realizing is that all of these beliefs that form this giant web, they're also dictating how they'll reason. One of the great studies that's also available on the internet was carried out at Harvard. It's called the implicit bias. And, you know, again, listening audience can Google this. We all have implicit biases. And sometimes the bias might be racial, and even though we don't think we do, we're surprised to find that we might. Or it might be against a sex, or it might be against an age, or it might be, you know, you name it. We have implicit biases. And these biases, they predetermine our expectation. Well, I already just showed you what an expectation does. It'll cause you to be drunk when you're drinking non-alcoholic beverages. It will cause you to see what's not there, light, dark, on a chessboard. So if we have this kind of a confinement in how we think, if we have further the definitions that we live by, you know, we, for all intent and purposes, find ourselves dealing with information that is carefully framed in our society. And by that, I mean, you know, we have a definition, and the definition has been built upon a framework. And that framework defines how we view things. My favorite example of this, and again, just to give the listening audience a real flavor of it, is the saliva in your mouth. If you think about the saliva in your mouth, and you're glad you have it. I'm glad I have it. I wouldn't be able to speak with you now if I didn't. In fact, I saw earlier today they're now advertising a new how to create more saliva in your mouth so you can avoid dry mouth. Okay?
Well, some people have those problems.
They do. They do indeed. So if you rate saliva, I have to rate mine very high. I'm going to give it right now a 9-10. I'm glad I have it. I could use a little extra. And if all the listening audience will think about that for a minute and rate their own saliva, then now what I want you to do is imagine you have just a little shot glass in front of you, and I want you to imagine that you're depositing a little of that saliva in the shot glass. So you just spit it in a shot glass. And now I want you to drink that back.
No way.
Yeah. See, 99% of the audience is going to go, whoa, wait a minute. The spit in the glass is vile, but the saliva in my mouth isn't.
It's the same thing.
It is. It is exactly the same thing, but it's how we have it framed.
That perception framing
is all important. You know, George, one of the things I do is pay attention to all this mind programming stuff that goes on. And I get paid to do that, so, you know, I'm watching two televisions not long ago, and there are two polls going on. One station, and they're the same poll, the same survey. On one station, a liberal station, they're asking a question that's being asked differently on the conservative. So on the conservative, we hear, should poor taxpayers be forced to pay for their children to go to private schools, maybe work two jobs because public schools are failing? You know, if I listen to that, I think, wow, no. On the liberal, what we heard was, should poor taxpayers be forced to pay for rich kids to go to private schools? Now, here's my point. Both of these surveys are about school vouchers, and we want to hear what we want to hear. We don't like to be agitated. If we have a belief system, we want that belief system left undisturbed. Great arguments come up over religion and politics among family members, to say nothing of strangers. So we just simply don't want it perturbed, which means that if our bias is liberal, we're going to be plugged into the liberal media. If our bias is conservative, we're plugged into the conservative media. So we're reinforcing the information that we already believe. We're in a cycle of telling ourselves what we want to hear through the means that we elect to get that information. That's problem number one. Problem number two is we don't examine the information ourselves. We're not likely to get on Google or go to the library and find out what are school vouchers, where does the money come from, who utilizes them, how does it impact public education, et cetera, and so forth. In other words, we don't do the homework. We instead take the soundbite and run with the soundbite, and that becomes how we reason. Well, if we're going to reason that way, if we're going to have these biases, if we're going to have this operation out of our unconscious, and, you know, this is a very important take-home. You know that they use functional magnetic resonance imaging for neuromarketing purposes.
Right.
We've discussed that.
Sure.
Okay, and that's great. But they, you know, we also use it for research. Researchers have now learned that the nucleus accumbens makes about 90% of all the decisions that we make. All right, now, MRI technicians watching the brain make a decision can know what you're going to decide as much as 10 seconds before you know. That ought to alarm people. I mean, listen, watching your brain, that MRI technician knows what you're going to do before you know what you're going to do. And he does so every time. That biocomputer, as a, you know, an analogy, that biocomputer is computing this information out of that repository we call the unconscious or the subconscious. And believe me, all the information that you have processed is there. Right? As a forensic hypnotist, I once had an individual that was convicted of murder. And it was a very gruesome homicide. Mm-hmm. He's convicted. He's in prison. I was asked to do hypnosis. The reason he couldn't remember anything that happened that evening was because he had consumed a lot of alcohol and done some very heavy drugs. So he had no recollection. Now, under hypnosis, he could tell us exactly how he went home. And in the process of telling us, he told us about a park he had to cut through. And he had to hide in that park. He was afraid of being arrested because there were two law enforcement officers searching the garbage. Now, we were able to look at police logs and see when they were there and how long they were there, and it matched what he was telling us, and it made it impossible, therefore, for him to be at the crime scene at the time of the homicide. Eventually, that led to his release, and, of course, law enforcement did ultimately capture the right person and see that he was put away.
Well, let me mention this real quick, too, Eldon, before we hit the break, in terms of perception, I believe. You know, when Eisenhower was running for the presidency after World War II, the American people, though they loved him, they did not want a general per se as president.
Right.
They were uptight about that. I mean, they wanted this democracy.
That's right.
So his aides and his strategists said, Dwight, you know, first of all, you're not going to wear your military suit on campaigns ever. We're going to put you in a suit, a business suit.
Yeah.
And that's what they did, and they transformed him where the American public saw this war hero, this general, but as a businessman, as a normal human being, and they loved him. He won by a landslide.
Yeah, and that happens all the time. And when you say that, I'm reminded, you know, listen, Barack Obama's people admit to having what they call the dream team of social psychologists assisting him in their last campaign. They include men like Cialdini, the man behind understanding, probably the leading man behind understanding what we call compliance principles.
It works. Eldon, we're going to talk more about that when we come right back.